This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Abortion legislation is making its way through state legislatures across the country. States including Alabama, Georgia, New York, and Vermont have introduced ever more controversial legislation that at once limits and in some cases expands access to abortions. Our state lawmakers are in the mix. Recent legislation outlawed abortion passed a 20-week cutoff point, but that law was overturned as unconstitutional. Still, in keeping with the national trend, policymakers in this state continue to introduce bills to place further restrictions on abortion. Joe Yerkeba is a North Carolina-based freelance journalist and editor who covers reproductive health rights. She joins me now to explain what's going on with abortion in our state. Hello, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Talk about our legislature here, the General Assembly in North Carolina, and the approach that they have taken now over the abortion issue.
Sure. So the approach they've mostly taken right now is to introduce controversial legislation that is largely opposed by advocates and medical experts. And when the governor has vetoed that legislation, they are trying to override it, both in the Senate and now in the House. And that's currently happening with what we call the Born Alive Survivors Protection Act is the name that they've given it.
All right. Talk more about that legislation.
Sure. So that legislation would pretty much charge an abortion provider with a felony if they don't provide life-saving care to a fetus that, quote-unquote, survives a botched late-term abortion. And late-term abortion is actually a politicized term. The correct medical term is later abortion, which occurs at 20 weeks or later. And doctors have said that this never happens. The co-sponsor of the bill, Senator Joyce Krawczyk, admitted that there's no evidence for how often infants are born alive after abortion attempts. The bill is mainly meant to just stigmatize later abortion even more than it already is.
And it's part of the strategy now to move the rhetoric to these very uncommon procedures and very uncommon ideas and events, late-term abortion, later abortions, because it turns out that most of the polls show that a majority of Americans support the right to abortion. So if that's where your majority is, you have to shift the conversation and the language to a more extreme point of view, and that is to say, are we taking lives? We've seen infanticide, for instance, is now making the rounds in the abortion debate. And this, it seems to me, is the kind of legislation that helps frame or helps support that kind of rhetoric around the abortion question.
Exactly. Yes, definitely. Tara Romano of NARAL Pro-Choice North Carolina had pointed out to me that that's exactly what they're doing, is trying to create the idea that we're killing live babies, even though, like you said, abortions after 20 weeks, less than 1% of abortions are that type of abortion. So they're very rare. They're usually in very sad, heartbreaking cases. And the majority of Americans do support abortion and support mothers having access to abortion in these tough cases, for example, when there are severe fetal abnormalities.
So we need to mark this moment as a real sharp turn in the rhetoric and the language that's surrounding what has always been, and for decades now, a controversial subject. The rhetoric has certainly changed. Also, several of the laws passed. This is one that, again, lands most heavily on providers and what they must do and the consequences they may face. But several laws in our state are aimed at changing patients' minds, too. Talk about that legislation.
Sure. Yes, in 2011, the General Assembly passed a law that requires a pregnant person to undergo counseling and an ultrasound before an abortion, and it also requires a physician to describe the image that they see on an ultrasound, despite the fact that that's medically unnecessary. And then in 2015, they passed another law that requires state-directed counseling that's designed to discourage people from having an abortion. And then they also passed a law that requires that someone wait 72 hours before seeing a physician and between when the procedure is provided. And that's meant to dissuade people from getting abortions, and it's built on this idea that they're going to change their mind, even though we have little evidence that that ever happens.
Though, do we have any evidence of what has happened as a result of the legislation itself? What's been the impact, or do we know?
Yes, the impact, especially of the 72-hour waiting period. North Carolina is only one of five states that requires a waiting period of that long, and that seriously puts people who are in lower income brackets, who are in eastern North Carolina where there are fewer abortion clinics, that puts them at a serious disadvantage, and they often can't access abortion because you have to take off 3-plus days from work to drive to an abortion clinic in the center of North Carolina. So it really pushes them into having to try to get abortions later, or they can't access them at all. And as we know, the later abortion happens, the harder it becomes to access and the more expensive.
Let's talk more about access in North Carolina. Overall, give us a snapshot. What does access to abortion look like in the state of North Carolina?
Sure. As of 2014, there were 37 abortion-providing facilities in North Carolina, and 16 of those were clinics. And a number of those are based in the Triangle in more populated areas of North Carolina, and there are very few in the southeastern part of North Carolina.
We talk about the right to an abortion through various court cases, especially Roe versus Wade, but others that have supported the right to an abortion. Question of viability, obviously, is central to all of this. What are the policies in place in North Carolina in terms of how far along pregnancy can be when an abortion is no longer legal?
Well, the law was that you could not have an abortion after 20 weeks. And as you mentioned, a federal judge recently struck that down. And he specifically cited Roe versus Wade, where the Supreme Court said that viability should be determined on a case-by-case basis by a physician. And there really is no determined week period when viability occurs.
So the 20-week was struck down. And is there legislation, I understand, legislation making its way through the legislature now that would actually shorten that?
Yes. It's House Bill 28 would ban abortions after 13 weeks, and that is incredibly early in a pregnancy. The majority of abortions take place usually between 9 and 13 weeks, but 10% do take place later than that. And so that would really seek to ban like a good portion of abortions, even though there's no reason for us to believe that 13 weeks is a cutoff point for viability.
Now, much of the abortion legislation that passed through the General Assembly and has become law in the state of North Carolina happened when both houses of the legislature and the governor's office were in Republican hands. That's different now, and Roy Cooper, a Democrat, is now the governor, and he no longer has a veto-proof legislature. How is the political dynamic changing in North Carolina?
The political dynamic has definitely changed. It's making it hard for them to get through these more extreme bills. But the issue is, I believe an article just came out today that they're still trying to push them through. And what they're doing is keeping these bills on the calendar and trying to force votes on them every day, which means that if a Democratic lawmaker or a handful of them aren't available to come into the House for medical procedures or if they have an illness, then Republicans have a better chance of pushing these bills through. So they're really trying this tactic where they kind of push things through at the last minute and try to like get it past Democrats, and it's a very strange strategy.
Right, but they may not get it past the governor, and then they'd have to override. Again, you could hope for the same thing, that a critical mass of Democrats don't show up for the override vote. But right now, they don't have the numbers in the House. I just wonder, from a political point of view, it seems to me a dicey proposition. You've got a majority of Americans in a purple state. We have a majority of Americans supporting abortion. You have a purple state where there are a majority of Democrats who vote. What's the strategy to force Governor Cooper to veto a bill, and then hopefully you would think if you're a Republican, you're going to use that in the general election, but does it work for you or against you? It's kind of a dicey proposition, it seems to me, politically.
It definitely is dicey, especially right now where our gerrymandered districts have led to there being much less representation for Democrats, even though about half the state, a little more than half the state, are Democrats. And so that means that they're trying to push through this extreme legislation like the Born Alive bill to kind of say, oh, look, Democrats support letting babies die when they've survived abortions, when in fact that's not really the case.
Is there any restriction now? I wonder what would happen. We talked about the governor's potential vetoes. Is there any legislation that's making its way through the GOP-led legislature that Governor Cooper might support?
I don't believe so, because when he vetoed the Born Alive Survivors Protection Act, he specifically noted that letting a newborn die is already illegal under current laws, and that it was a law designed to come between someone getting an abortion and their health care provider. So I believe that he really stands firmly with like science-based legislation, and I think that there is very little that he would actually support in terms of limiting access to abortion.
And in terms of activism on both sides of this debate, obviously we're hearing about sort of a ratcheted up tone in the debate. There's more volume. Are the activist groups as well organizing, and are they growing in strength and in commitment?
Yes, I think that activist groups are definitely growing. I attended one of the clinic rallies on Tuesday night in Raleigh, and there were probably 200 people crowded in front of one of these tiny clinics. And so I think that the pro-choice voices are definitely growing alongside the pro-life voices, which I think are really increasing momentum right now because they kind of know that this is their like last gas effort to push through legislation like this while the GOP is still in control and while President Trump is in office.
All right. Joe Yerkeba is a North Carolina-based freelance journalist and editor who covers reproductive health rights. Joe, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
You can find links to her reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, how North Carolina compares to other states where the national current of abortion legislation seems to be headed. We'll talk more about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina legislators have been restricting women's ability to receive abortions for years. They've imposed requirements on patients and mandated that clinicians provide non-medical counseling before conducting a procedure. Other states with conservative lawmakers in power have acted similarly. Now the debate over abortion seems to be taking on more significance nationally and generating more friction as a hot-button issue in play for the 2020 election. The Guttmacher Institute is a research and policy organization committed to advancing sexual and reproductive health and rights. Elizabeth Nash is senior state issues manager there, and she's looked at the numbers across the country. She's looked at the numbers and analyzed the trends, and she's here to put North Carolina into context for us. Elizabeth Nash, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
It is good to have you here. You know, we think we know what Roe versus Wade is, but tell us exactly legally what it does and what it says.
Sure. So, you know, in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down really two decisions that day, and we don't really ever talk about Doe v. Bolton, but they handed down two. Roe v. Wade, that struck down the Texas abortion ban, and Doe v. Bolton, which dealt with a Georgia abortion restriction. And together, what these two decisions did was say that the right to abortion is affirmed across in the country. And what it really meant was that states cannot ban abortion before viability, which is a point in pregnancy between about 24 and 28 weeks. So the state can't do that. But if the state does ban abortion after viability, there have to be protections so that the woman's life and health, if either of those are at risk, she could still get an abortion. And that has been the law of the land for 46 years. Certainly the court has weighed in and some things have changed and states have been allowed to adopt more restrictions, but that's the basic setup.
All right, so give us the big picture about abortion in America and in terms of what we've seen over time. I want to really focus at this moment on the overall rates of abortion and those trends really since those decisions.
Sure. So what you saw is what you might expect, right? When something that was illegal becomes legal, providers and patients and lawmakers are all trying to figure out how to regulate and provide care. So the rates were going up, and they went up until about 1982. And since 1982, they have been declining. And so where we are now is really nationally at about a rate of about 14 per 1,000 women. So that's a much lower rate than what we've seen. And North Carolina's rate is really in that ballpark at about 15. So it's a rate that does vary across states. So states with higher urban populations tend to have higher rates, and states with more rural populations as well as lower access to abortion have lower rates.
What accounts for the decline, do you think?
A lot of things. I can give you some ideas around some factors that have been part of this. And part of it really has been access to contraception. So if we think about what was available back in 1982 or even 1995, contraception has changed. We have better long-acting methods such as IUDs. We have the ring and the patch. We have many different forms of the pill. We have emergency contraception, all of these things. And more, much more recently, you know, we have a federal law that requires contraceptive coverage. And that law, the Affordable Care Act, also has expanded access to insurance coverage, making contraceptive more available and more affordable for people. So that's one thing. Another issue is that we've seen perhaps people's preferences change over time a little bit for children. And certainly we saw this with the recession from starting around 2008 to about 2010, 2011, although it was extended in some places. People decided to delay having children at that point. And also we're seeing later marriage. That has affected things too. But one of the things that is not always reflected in a national rate is state variation. And one of the things where states really vary is on abortion access. So, for example, in 2013 and 2014, Texas lost over half of its abortion clinics. So it went from over 40 to under 20. And over a similar period, Ohio lost about half of its clinics as well, going down from 14 to 8. So in states where you see clinics close, rates may be going down, but it's because of reduced access, not because there's a reduced need for abortion.
And I suspect that's because of legislation that may have restricted those facilities or not.
Absolutely. So, you know, in Texas, that is a prime example where the state enacted abortion restrictions on clinics, and these restrictions really required abortion clinics to become mini hospitals and required providers to have admitting privileges as a local hospital. And those restrictions went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in 2016, the Supreme Court struck them down, upholding abortion rights as part of our fabric of our nation. But what has happened is we haven't seen all those clinics open up again because it's very difficult to reopen a clinic once it is closed. So access is still not where it was back 5-6 years ago.
We're talking about the number of ways that legislatures across the country have moved to restrict abortions. Lawmakers mm-hmm. have removed coverage from state health plans. They've required younger patients to get written consent. They've also imposed additional requirements on health care providers, as we've just said. And that's an approach that Mara Bookbinder has studied. She's an associate professor of social medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she joins the conversation now. Mara, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've studied laws that have been targeted or have targeted clinicians. These restrictions are sometimes called trap laws. Tell us about those, how they work, and especially in North Carolina.
Sure. So the rise of trap laws or targeted regulation of abortion providers is really a legacy of the Supreme Court's decision in 1992 in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And what the Supreme Court decided at that time is that states do have a right to limit and even restrict abortion as long as laws did not place an undue burden on women. Now, this undue burden clause is a little bit vague and subjective, but practically speaking, the effect was to really to have states that were seeking to limit abortion target providers by placing restrictions on clinics and individual providers so that they could argue, you know, these are really for the protection of women's health and safety, and they're not placing obstacles in women's paths.
Were any of these evidence-based? Was there any evidence that women were being given these procedures in unsafe situations?
No, there really hasn't been strong evidence of that fact, right? Mm-hmm. It seems to be that the strategy is more around making access difficult.
What has the effect been in North Carolina, both on access, but then also how have providers responded?
Right. So my colleagues and I did some research looking at the impact of a 2011 law that, among other things, mandated that that abortion providers offer counseling with certain content dictated by the state. And it's important to, you know, to keep in mind that abortion always involves counseling. That's just part of the process and always has been. But what's different about these laws is that they often require non-medical content. For example, in North Carolina, providers are required to say that the father of the pregnancy would be required to pay child support if the pregnancy were carried to term, and that women would have access to assistance from the state if the pregnancy were carried to term. So you can imagine that in certain cases, offering these kinds of disclosures could be very upsetting to women. For example, to someone who had experienced a rape, or someone that was terminating the pregnancy because of a devastating fetal anomaly. So what we found in our research is that providers really do a lot to kind of try to minimize the impact on patients and not impede access. We also found that in the case of this mandated counseling law, it was really difficult for them in some cases to offer this counseling that they viewed as harmful to certain patients. And so they developed strategies to kind of distance themselves from the content of what they're about to say by saying something like, you know, I'm required by state law to give you this information, but I just want you to know that I don't necessarily agree with what I'm going to tell you.
And can we tell what kind of impact that has had? Again, do we know if people are changing their minds, if this is having obviously the desired impact? If you're passing this legislation, has very little to do with the medical evidence and everything to do with an ideology, but does it have the impact that they desire?
Sure. So, I mean, the research that I did was qualitative research, so we don't know too much about absolute numbers from this particular law. But what we heard from providers is that it didn't seem to be preventing too many abortions overall. And part of that is because providers were doing a lot of work to minimize impact, right? And to sort of not have patients experience some of the barriers that might accrue from these laws. Now, as the waiting periods get longer and as some of the restrictions become more burdensome, then I think that most likely they do impact the ability to access an abortion.
Elizabeth Nash, what do we know about public sentiment and how it has changed over time? I mean, what do we have in terms of a timeline about public opinion on the question of abortion?
Well, you know, basically we had the same questions asked for 46 years, and pretty much the entire time the public has supported abortion rights. The issue is, do those questions actually measure a real understanding of abortion? And that is sometimes questioned because the way the questions have been framed really reflects a debate from about 20 years ago. So, in fact, people are trying new methods in testing out how to measure public opinion. And some of the most recent research is really showing that 7 in 10 people support abortion rights. So well over half.
We haven't yet been able to detect the impact of the shift in rhetoric where the anti-abortion forces are trying to conflate legal abortion with illegal abortions.
Right.
The late term terms like infanticide, the image of a fully, you know, of a woman coming to full term, which has never been the question, but apparently now has entered the debate.
Right. And, you know, using that kind of inflammatory rhetoric and really demonizing providers and stigmatizing abortion is something that we've seen from abortion opponents for decades. They did that when they coined terms. You may remember the debate from the 90s and the early 2000s around so-called partial birth abortion. Or some of the debates more recently over banning an abortion method that is the primary method used after 14 weeks of pregnancy. So it really is the only method you can use. So basically, they take they describe in very graphic terms medical procedures, and they use that to make abortion seem dangerous and providers seem callous. And in that way, they stigmatize abortion and try to change the conversation from focusing on the woman and her needs to really focusing on something else.
Mara Bookbinder, the reason this is such an important issue and one that is so emotional and gets so much attention is because it is, in many ways, a deep moral question, and it is a question of conscience. And there was a recent amendment to the so-called conscience rule that I'd like you to explain what that is and how clinicians have responded to that.
Sure. And, you know, you could probably do a whole other show about that, Frank, but basically purpose of that rule was to protect the rights of physicians and other healthcare workers and healthcare entities that might want to refuse to offer certain healthcare services for moral or religious reasons. So this is interesting to me in part because when we hear about conscience in the news, it often kind of focuses on the ethics of refusal. So under what circumstances can providers refuse to participate in various healthcare, often having to do with reproductive services, but end-of-life services as well. And then also the question of if they do refuse, are they obligated to refer patients to other providers who can provide that service? One of the things that has really come out of a lot of the work that I've done is that conscience can also be a positive force in medicine, and it can really compel providers to offer certain kinds of healthcare as well. And I think that that's sort of another side of the conscience debate that we're not hearing enough about.
And how would that, is that a debate that's happening, can you tell, among doctors, among medical professionals? The question of whether or not, you know, because you can think there was the same issue, the same question that applied in the application of injections for the death, for capital punishment. And physicians weighed in and said, we don't take lives, we save lives. And that was their argument. And it was a conscientious argument at the time. Does that same, is there a sort of equivalence there in those arguments?
So, I mean, again, that's another argument for conscientious refusal. One of the things that I hear when I speak to providers of abortion, but also physicians who participate in assisted suicide or aid in dying, is that they are compelled to participate in these kinds of practices because of their conscience, and that there may be moral and even religious reasons that they want to engage in those kinds of healthcare activities.
Elizabeth, we hear horror stories about what's happening to women when abortions are not legal. Are those coming, you know, what's happening to those these days? We don't hear about it as much because, you know, since 1972, that hasn't been the case. Those stories haven't been in the news. And also, I suppose, because of access to contraceptives and online pharmaceuticals, that has changed the question. Has this debate changed much as a result of all of that?
Well, you know, what we have really seen is that with legal abortion comes access, of course, right? But what we're seeing across the country is that access is so dictated by where you live. And so, right, if we're thinking about the South, we're thinking about the Midwest, we're thinking about the Plains, access is much more limited than when you're thinking about the West or the Northeast or perhaps Illinois in the middle. So, but as far as if we're thinking about a time when, and I think what you're getting to with your question was getting to a time where abortion could potentially be illegal again, right? We're seeing all these abortion bans move through state legislatures. They want, you know, the idea is to kickstart a legal case that will end up before this newly conservative Supreme Court and overturn Roe v. Wade, right? So potentially thinking about a time that abortion may be illegal. I think that, you know, what we would see is something very different than what we saw before Roe, because we have more methods of abortion and because of the internet. And so, you know, we would see, obviously, some people be able to access services, because they have finances and ways to move around the country or to another state. But, you know, for other people, yes, they may self-manage an abortion on their own, but probably the kinds of stories we heard about from before Roe would not be what we would be hearing about then.
But obviously people with low wealth families, individuals who did not have means would once again be at a disadvantage.
Absolutely. And they remain at a disadvantage right now. Right. If you're thinking about the fact that a typical abortion costs $500, Most people are paying out of pocket. If you have to travel, as the way Joe was describing, from sort of to the center of North Carolina, you have a 72-hour waiting period. You're talking about travel arrangements. You're talking about finding a car, perhaps. You're talking about taking time off of work that probably isn't paid. And you're talking about arranging for childcare, because you know 60% of people who are seeking an abortion already have a child. So you're talking about layering on a very large, heavy financial burden that really a lot of people, maybe not quite half of people, say that if they were had a burden of $400 or $500 placed on them, they wouldn't be able to come up with that money. So, you know, yes, yes, absolutely, to answer your question, it would hit those with low incomes, people of color, and young people hardest.
Elizabeth Nash is a senior state issues manager at the Guttmacher Institute. That's a research and policy organization that focuses on sexual and reproductive health and rights. Mara Bookbinder is an associate professor of social medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to talk with a North Carolina attorney who played a key role in the Watergate investigation, wondering if that has anything to do with the situation today in Washington. We'll find out in a minute. Stay tuned.